Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, December 2nd, 2015. A pointed message from Putin to Erdogan. Don't mess with me. Little Kim sings the threats to open up our podcast today, and following the shootdown of the Russian fighter jet in a dispute over Turkish airspace, the battle of words is escalating, and it is extremely personal. Vladimir Putin has authorized his military leaders to disclose information he says proves that the president of Turkey, Erdogan, and his family members are personally profiting from trafficking in the black market oil that is being pulled out of the ground in Syria and perhaps Iraq, and then trucked across the border into Turkey. And this is very personal. As I reported yesterday, Erdogan has said that if this can be proven, that he will resign. And he dares Putin, if he's unable to prove it, to resign himself. So this mano-a-mano conflict is growing despite the efforts by President Obama and others to soothe the tensions and get people to focus on defeating the Islamic State instead of fighting one another. And this raises a lot of important questions, because let's assume for a moment that at least half of what Russia is alleging is true. They are saying that Erdogan and his sons are personally profiting from the oil that is being shipped out of Syria. And they trotted out Deputy Defense Minister Anatoly Antonov in Moscow today. The main customer for this oil, stolen from Syria and Iraq, is Turkey. The top political leadership of the country, President Erdogan and his family, is involved in this criminal business. Now, that is really pointed. And we know that the Islamic State has been generating revenue by shipping oil, particularly out of Syria. Now, we're going to get to the questions in a moment that affect the United States in this regard. But as I mentioned, Erdogan has kind of doubled down and his comment was, those who make such slanderous claims are obliged to prove them. If they do, I would not remain on the presidential seat for 1 minute. But those who make the claim must also give up their seat if they can't prove it. Well, Antonov says that the Islamic State makes about $2 billion a year from the illegal oil trade. And Antonov said, maybe I'm speaking too bluntly, but the control over that thievish business could only be given to the closest people. Adding that Erdogan's son heads a top energy company, his son-in-law has been named Turkey's energy minister. And Lieutenant General Sergei Rutskoy of the Russian military's general staff said that Russian airstrikes on the Islamic State oil infrastructure have cut in half the group's profits, and that those air raids have destroyed 32 oil production facilities, 11 refineries, and over 1,000 oil trucks in the last 60 days. So this is a very serious set of charges, and it attempts to lift the hazy fog of war and the media curtain over about who profits from this ongoing conflict in Syria and from the ascendance of the Islamic State. So President Obama joined in just before leaving Paris. And I'm reading here from an article from Vice News with the byline, Ryan Faith. President Obama just told the Turks that they need to get their act together and stop the massive flow of people, money, and supplies trying to get into Syria, and the oil artifacts and more people trying to get out. But Ryan Faith says this raises the important question, why now? And we have to ask, after more than 8,000 bombing runs by the U.S. Air Force and military in the last 14 months. Why were those targets still available for Russia to hit? Why didn't the United States take out this critical infrastructure that clearly has been benefiting the Islamic State or ISIL that we say we want to degrade and defeat? And so it just raises more questions about the way the U.S. appears to have been going through the motions and bombing and killing people, but not really attempting to defeat the Islamic State. And Ryan Faith notes that there's a very porous border that has been a smuggling route for decades, and it's been very lucrative for both sides. But with our vaunted intelligence and all the drones and spy satellites, why is it that Russia could see these convoys of tanker trucks transiting from Syria into Turkey, but the United States did not? And these are questions we'll continue to explore and continue to ask until we get some answers. Now, also in Paris, yesterday, President Obama told reporters, and I find this so far-fetched. I'll just read you from the Associated Press. President Obama expressed optimism Tuesday that Russia will ultimately come around on the need for Syrian President Bashar Assad to leave power to end his country's long civil war, but he warned the turnaround would not come overnight. Quote, I don't expect that you're going to see a 180-degree turn on their strategy over the next several weeks. They have invested for years now in keeping Assad in power. Their presence there is predicated on propping him up. That's going to take some time for them to change how they think about the issue. Obama said he expects that diplomatic negotiations in Vienna to pursue a political solution will move forward at the same time that the U.S.-led coalition applies greater pressure to defeat the Islamic State. He says that ISIL, as he likes to call it, is going to continue to be a deadly organization. It's going to continue to be a serious threat for some time to come. But I see no basis to believe that Russia or Iran or other supporters of Assad will change their tune. And because we allowed the Islamic State to metastasize in western Iraq and in northern Syria, because it suited our purposes in trying to remove Assad from power? Well, tomorrow I'll be releasing an important interview with Andrew J. Basevich. He's a retired Army colonel, retired professor of history from Boston University, a sharp critic of Obama's policies. And he has quite a bit to say about this, and we will share that with you tomorrow on this podcast. Meanwhile, the Pentagon boss, Ashton Carter, told a congressional committee yesterday more mission creep in this war. He said that U.S. will establish a special operations targeting force in Iraq as part of the intensified military effort to fight the Islamic State. And, of course, this is a meaningless announcement. As I reported to you yesterday, Kurdish fighters have shown videos to reporters confirming that Americans have been on the front lines since at least last April. And we know that this does not address covert operations, which have been active in Iraq and Syria for at least 3, if not 4 years. And so there are so many games being played, so much manipulation of information and who is who and who's doing what, that it just reduces this to an incredible mess. And the U.S. should be looking for a graceful way to exit, but it does not appear that that's an option on the table. I love how Obama always says that all options are on the table, but in Afghanistan there was never an option to reduce troop levels when he was bent on his surge. And now he is so mired in with his own ego, Putin's ego, Erdogan's ego, and then the domestic politics with John McCain and Lindsey Graham demanding that we immediately ship 20,000 troops into that war zone. And I commend the president for resisting that call. But at the same time, we see the mission creep of 50 troops here and 100 troops there, and it doesn't take too much to get to 10,000. As I'm speaking today, it's about 2:20 p.m. Pacific time. There is a mass shooting underway in Southern California, in the town of San Bernardino. There are reported to be three heavily armed shooters who were wearing body armor, according to one report. We know there are multiple fatalities. One report, this is all fragmentary, says that 12 people have been killed, and multiple reports say at least 20 people have been shot or killed. And what's unusual is they went to a building. It's not a Planned Parenthood clinic or anything like that. It's what we have all across California are called regional centers. Regional centers are nonprofit areas where services and resources are available for the disabled, for mentally retarded people, for others with so-called special needs. And the room where we think the shooting broke out had been rented by someone else for a holiday party. So these are just initial reports trickling in. But it's very troubling to see more gun violence erupting here in the United States. Every day I like to pause for a moment and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. People like Wendy Gebauer, Abby McMillan. She does much more than she needs to. Thanks, Abby. Natalie Real in Montana, Gunnar Gunderson in Saudi Arabia. I appreciate each and every one of you. And I'd like you, and I'm talking to you with the earbuds, who has never heard your name mentioned here, to step up and become a subscriber and help support what I do here. Go to peterbcollins.com, upper right corner on the homepage, the menu button, you pull that down. The next tab, you click on Become a Subscriber. And on that page, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, a one-time contribution of any amount, a $50 annual subscription. New annual subscribers get my bonus gift, Pepe Escobar's ebook edition of his latest book called Empire of Chaos. And in the next few days, I hope to be announcing a way that Android smartphone users can easily access the Peter B. Collins podcast. Now, before he left Paris, President Obama addressed the climate talks and the progress being made there, and he sounds optimistic. He said, I actually think we're going to solve this problem. Well, that seems to me a little too optimistic. And the real problem for President Obama is that, similar to the way when Al Gore went to Kyoto in, 1998? Obama doesn't have complete backing at home. And the Republican-controlled House of Representatives is expected today to pass two bills that would block Obama's major initiatives on climate change, including the EPA rules to try to reduce coal-fired power plants and their emissions. And even if you're a skeptic of climate change, and I know that there are many people across the political spectrum who are skeptical, I really think that it is in our interests, even if all we do is reduce air pollution, for you skeptics who don't believe that carbon produced by humans is contributing to global warming. At minimum, our own health and safety would be enhanced, and weaning ourselves from fossil fuels can only be a good thing because we're going to run out sometime. Now, I'm not conceding the argument here. I am a believer that climate change is induced and exacerbated by human behavior. But I'm appealing to those who don't accept that notion to get out of the way, because it cannot hurt us to address these issues. And the idea that American jobs are more important than addressing this issue is just a false argument, in my opinion. Well, we've heard Republican governors across the country say, my state will not permit any Syrian refugees because they're coming to kill us. And big old Chris Christie in New Jersey is one of the biggest fat mouths on this subject. And he has been silenced because he made empty promises. He made a vow not to accept any more Syrian refugees. But the fact is, he doesn't have that authority. And so, on Monday night, a family of seven Syrian refugees moved into a house near Paterson, New Jersey, and there is nothing Chris Christie can do about it. In this article from the New York Times, Mr. Christie has no authority over a federal program that has for decades resettled refugees from all nations. Now, he's threatened to cut state services or prevent refugees from accessing them, but that would be a violation of New Jersey's law against discrimination. And so he can rant and rave and rail all he wants, but the fact is that he has no leverage to carry out the representations he has made in pandering to Republican voters. Now, this is a story that shows how oblivious the Zionist leadership of Israel is to, at minimum, the optics, if not the real impact of their actions. Now, Israel for years has used a very controversial policy of demolishing the homes of people they accuse or convict of terrorist actions. And so on Wednesday, they deployed 1,200 armed soldiers to a small Palestinian refugee camp in East Jerusalem. 1,200 troops. Now, this is a stormtrooper situation. And they went in and demolished the family home of an alleged Hamas militant who they say carried out a terrorist attack last year that killed two Israelis. Now, this is a kind of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, biblical justice that we repudiate when it's used by Saudi Arabia to execute people, or, as we'll get to in a moment, by Iran to execute an American who they accused of a crime in the United States. But the, how can I put it, the self-consciousness of Israeli leaders is so lacking that they feel justified in this kind of a maneuver. And it can only inflame Palestinian feelings and their sense of victimization under the boot of the powerful Israeli military. And I've seen a lot of commentary on Facebook the last couple of days from pro-Israeli voices who were rejecting the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement and accusing those of us who support it of automatic anti-Semitism. Now, they too are oblivious to the underlying issues that lead people like me to support BDS. At Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, we have just completed one of those detainee review board hearings. And the U.S. is acknowledging that a man who has been held there for 13 years is the wrong guy. It is a case of mistaken identity. And the victim of it is Mustafa Al-Aziz Al-Shamiri, age 37, a native of Yemen, who at best was a low-level Islamist foot soldier and not an Al-Qaeda courier and trainer as previously thought because, well, they confused him with somebody else. His official designation is YM434. That's his prisoner number. The YM, I think, stands for Yemen. And he has been what's called an indefinite detainee, one of the people in limbo, considered too dangerous to release, but unable to be tried because, well, there isn't enough evidence or the evidence was derived from nefarious means like torture. And this is just another case of how wrong-headed the U.S. has been, not only in operating the Guantanamo prison, but in the ridiculous standards used to accuse and hold people there. So much of it has been based on hearsay and on very weak evidence. And that's why it is such a blight on the reputation of our country. Human Rights Watch is demanding an investigation, a criminal investigation, of senior Bush administration officials and others for torture, conspiracy to torture, and other crimes. They've just released a 153-page report that is based on the Senate Intelligence Committee executive summary that was partially redacted that was released just about a year ago. And this is a real obvious call. And as we know, President Obama has obstructed justice. This article that came from the Chicago Tribune Network puts it this way: the Obama administration closed the door on what would have been politically volatile prosecutions of CIA officers or White House officials. Yes, by saying we'll look forward, not backward, Obama and Holder at the Justice Department obstructed justice. They made a call not to pursue clear information that is obvious to almost anyone that it crossed the line into criminal behavior. And this undermines our Constitution, our credibility as a nation of laws, and the reputation of Barack Obama. Now, here's an interesting story from Guantanamo that appeared in Sunday's New York Times. You've heard statistics bandied about certain people who are at Guantanamo and quote-unquote returned to the battlefield. Well, the Times gives us information about a former Guantanamo prisoner named Haji Ghalib. And the opening line reads, he returned to the Afghan battlefield. But he's fighting on our side. And this, of course, is quite surprising, highly unusual. And it blows away the argument that just about everybody who leaves Guantanamo is a risk to the United States. Now, what's interesting is that it contrasts Ghalib with another former Guantanamo prisoner who is back on the battlefield and who is on the other side. His name is Dost, Abdul Rahim Muslim Dost. He lived, maybe even have been a cellmate of Ghalib at Guantanamo. And the Times writes, while Mr. Ghalib chose to reject bitterness and fight on behalf of the American-backed government, his former friend, Mr. Dost, now leads the Islamic State fighters whom Ghalib's forces are trying to drive out of eastern Afghanistan. And Ghalib's own story is a comedy of errors. He was a police chief for the Afghan government after the Taliban was forced out in 2001, but he was arrested for apparently having explosive devices at the government compound where he worked. And they claim that letters that linked him to the Taliban were likely forged. But nevertheless, he spent a number of years at Guantanamo Bay. I mentioned a moment ago about this case in Iran, and this one is quite bizarre. An Iranian-American man has been executed in Iran for a crime that he allegedly committed in Los Angeles 7 years ago, even though there is no judicial treaty between Iran and the U.S., making it impossible for Iranian authorities to have gathered information or evidence in order to try the man. His name is Hamed Samei, S-A-M-E-I-E, also known as Sam. He was hanged last month in the Raji Shah prison in Karaj, west of the capital of Tehran. And the story goes back to 2008, where one Iranian-American was shot to death in his home in Woodland Hills outside Los Angeles. And this guy, Sam, left the country, showed up in Iran, and ultimately they tried him and convicted him. But we don't know what evidence was used and if it was compelling or conclusive. And this, again, is a very unusual case. And we'll see if the U.S. has any protests about it. Two more quick ones here today. Yesterday I mentioned this dubious report from George Washington University about Americans trying to join the Islamic State and argued that many of these people are framed. Well, here's the latest. A 22-year-old California man has pleaded guilty to trying to join Islamic extremists in Syria and could face up to 15 years in prison. His name is Nicholas Toussaint. He entered a plea to one count of attempting to provide material support. Now, what's interesting is this story from the Associated Press mentions his paid FBI informant in the third paragraph. Usually they bury it at the end. It says Toussaint was arrested in March of 14 in Washington State. He planned to travel to Canada, then on to Syria to join the Islamic State. He discussed his plans with a friend who was actually an FBI informant. His lawyers said that he had a mental illness that made him vulnerable to the informant, had no real plans of joining the group. He had previously been found incompetent to stand trial, but was ruled competent in August. So, the FBI claims another scalp in their vaunted war on domestic terrorism. But this is another flimsy case at best, and more likely, another frame-up. Finally today, the Internal Revenue Service has pledged not to use the cell phone tracking system, the cell phone simulator called Stingray, or its companion devices like the Dirtbox, without a warrant. And this is progress, because the FBI has these devices and they use them without a warrant. Local police agencies, other law enforcement groups have Stingrays and Dirtboxes, and most of them don't apply for warrants to use them. So I applaud the IRS, because it's the right thing to do. And any agency that uses one of these devices without a warrant is in clear violation of the unambiguous language of the Fourth Amendment. And at least in the case of the IRS, they can't claim that they're protecting us from terrorists. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. This free podcast is free for you to share with absolutely everyone. And I hope you will. I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.